online communities of LGBTQ Muslims and allies are not difficult to find these days. Real life support, however, is far more difficult to locate. But it's not impossible, and one of the leaders who make that possible is Imam Dayu Abdullah. Delighted to be able to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. Imam Abdullah, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Reverend Gaddy, and I'm happy to be here.
You were raised Baptist and converted to Islam at age 30. Can I start by asking how that came about?
Well, it was a step-by-step process. Though both of my parents were Baptists, they're Southern Baptists, actually, there in Detroit, where I grew up. At the age of 8, I realized that there was something there that wasn't quite sitting well within me, within my spiritual self. And so I spoke with them and asked them about studying other religions to learn more about the expanse and the breadth of faith. And them being educated people, they agreed. And so being in Detroit, because of the auto industry, people came there from all over the world. I was exposed to a wide array of different religious beliefs, from Judaism to even Buddhism, because one of my elementary friends growing up, his father was black and mother was Korean. They married coming from the Korean War. So I was exposed to a wide array of different religious beliefs that were there. And eventually, as I was coming out of high school, I got involved in metaphysics. And then from there, I eventually did some study in Buddhism and also other aspects of the Hindu faith. And then at the age of 30, I was in China, and it was there at Beijing University that I was introduced to Islam through some of my Hui, which are the ethnic Chinese Muslims, that introduced me to Islam there.
I was going to ask you which came first, the spiritual awakening in you or coming to terms with your sexuality, but I am assuming that your exploration in spirituality came first and then dealing with sexuality came second.
Well, actually, it was around the same time. I knew that as a very young child, around 5 years old, that I was uniquely different from the other boys that I knew. And therefore, my difference was not that I didn't play baseball and football and ride bikes and do all those things together, but I just knew that there was something about me that was different than what the other boys understood about their sexuality. And it was something that I didn't explore, but as I grew older, that was something that did come out. So I think that both of them happened around the same time in terms of my spiritual development, as well as my understanding of myself as being a person who was a boy who liked other boys.
So did how did the spirituality that you had experienced relate to the sexuality that you were identifying?
Well, that's to put it in a way I think most people would be able to understand. As I entered high school, I wound up going to high school at 12 because I would go to summer school every year. So I wound up entering high school 3 years early and graduating at 15. That the exploration of teenage love was one of the ways in which it developed. So I think that's the way in which it grew in terms of my understanding myself as a teenager, but also in my educational process of understanding spirituality. I knew there was great diversity there in the world in terms of spirit and religion. And then I also saw that that same thing manifest in me in terms of sexual orientation.
I see. How did you move into religious leadership?
Well, that came in somewhat of a different way. After I had finished college, you know, my studies overseas, and had come back, done law school, and had practiced law for a little while, and then went back to the Middle East for some more graduate study. It was back in the U.S., back in the early 2000s, that I received an email from someone, an anonymous person, who said that there was a young Muslim man who had died of HIV who was in the morgue, and no one had claimed his body. And would I be willing to do his janazah or funeral prayer for him? And I'd always believed from my early beginnings, because both my parents were civil rights advocates as well, that I believed that every human being had the right, R-I-G-H-T, for their religious rights, R-I-T-E-S. Mm-hmm. And so I agreed to go and do it. I called the morgue, went down, and performed the religious prayer and did the shrouding. And I didn't have the money to actually do a funeral for him, but I was able to do those services. And I felt that that was the way. And when people heard about that, they took on that's when I got the title of Imam, when actually I was studying to become a sheikh, more of a scholar in Islam. Hmm. But then I realized the LGBTQ Muslim community needed someone as a leader, so I accepted that role.
I know that your early ministry was focused on serving those who were rejected by organized religion, whether they were Muslim or followers of other Abrahamic religions. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Okay. One of the things that was consistent, and I based it on lack of education. Within the Islamic faith, the education is based on a particular narrowly defined and prescribed understanding of what sexual diversity means within the Islamic concept, as much as it is like in Christianity and Judaism to a certain extent, that the people needed someone to talk to. And I've always believed that it's important to listen to people and understand them, and then to also convey some of my own personal life experiences to them so that there's a connection between us. It's almost like the way in which if you can get someone through a sense of humor, that it's easier for them to connect with you as a person. So I did the same type of thing. And once we were able to connect, my words meant more to them because they felt that I was listening to them and understanding the turmoil, the trauma, and the difficulties that they were facing, and my own personal experiences were able to guide them in a way to help them bridge the gap, so to speak, from where they were to understanding that life can get better and give them the types of tools and or guidelines to help them make that progression. Mm-hmm. For example, I had a couple of teenagers or young adults who were talking about how they had had problems or they had friends who committed suicide. Well, I was able to tell them about my teenage love, my first love, Otis, who had committed suicide in my senior year of high school. And so people were able to connect because I had an experience and then they could understand. And so that helped me understand that these are some of the same problems that young people and young adults experience, and that I was able to survive it, and these were the tools I used to help me do that. Mm. And I was always able to connect.
Many religions have softened their stance on LGBTQ persons in the past 20 years. How have these changes affected Muslims in your own work?
Well, I think that although I was one of the earlier ones out there in terms of dealing with LGBTQ religious issues, I think it gave a lot of people encouragement to understand that we do exist. And for those individuals who followed the more traditional line that although we may exist, we were not within the guidelines, within the framework of the Muslim community, the re-education process has been very, very important. And being part of that, because we have a number of scholars today who over the last two decades have come out themselves but also helped in the scholarly research that is there. But I think that I played a more important role in understanding how Islamic law works within society, or how law works within the society, and how people generally will adjust their life and how they live their lives in public through that process.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how that has been a major change, because in my, thankfully, I have a scholarship, but also the ability to translate the academic scholarship into layman terms. And so I think that's where the real strength has happened, and that's why there's been a monumental move. And when I say monumental, meaning that for the younger the people are, Muslims are, the more open they are to the LGBT community, not just because of me, but also because of the change in how LGBT people are being understood in Western society.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, and you've already addressed this to a certain extent, but I want to go up a little further with it. Across your years, what has been the biggest challenge that you faced in your work?
I think the biggest challenge, which I think is just part of being outsiders, I mean, the LGBTQ community are outsiders of the mainstream society, is the issue of self-acceptance and the process of then finding that, building that inner strength to be able to deal with those particular issues. Now, my parents were very supportive of me. When I came out of high school, I told them that I was gay, and we had that conversation, which I think many gay people have had with their parents. But my parents were very extremely supportive, and they told me, you have upheld all the standards that we have for your brothers and sister, and you know, there's nothing wrong with you. And it helped me, that gave me an opportunity to bridge, to help them better understand them having a gay child, but also that the things that they taught me, that they could depend on me standing up and having the standards that they could be proud of, no matter what my sexual orientation.
Mm. Well, you had great parents. Can you think of one experience, or if you want to do two, fine, of a story that would illuminate the journey mm-hmm. that you've been on all these years?
Well, there are a couple of them. Let's see, which ones would I want to convey?
Say them both.
Okay. Well, one of them has been in the last 2 decades or so, in terms of being able to talk with people and get them to understand that we all have a lot of things in common, and we do not have to just rely upon what people tell us, but that we must take the steps forward in order to educate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, it's not really a story per se, but it's one of the mantras that I try to import for people, so that I sit down with them and talk about those particular verses and how those verses can be interpreted one way, but if you look at it from a different perspective, those other perspectives, alternative views, have as much validity in terms of understanding what the Quranic message means.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps people to move beyond the fallacies that are often projected onto people, you know, the bandwagon fallacy. Everybody believes a certain way, so you should believe that way as well. And then one of the others that I think was rather sort of anecdotal, in a way, when I was living in Saudi Arabia in the late 90s, I had a conversation with a gentleman. I'm naturally left-handed, mm-hmm. and there, in that particular culture, being right-handed is the preferred way in which you interact, particularly when you eat. And I had a conversation with the gentleman, and he was like, well, you should do like the prophet, because the prophet was right-handed. And I told him, I said, well, although that may be true, I am not going to mimic or ape the practices of the prophet in order to make other people comfortable when I am naturally left-handed. And that is my right, quote-unquote, right hand to use. And then the general at the Air Force base that I was teaching at, he says, Dai, come over here and talk with me. And he said to me, he says, you have to understand that sometimes people have not had exposure to things. And because of that, they believe a certain way. But you, like me, we've lived in other parts of the world, we've traveled, things of this nature, that it's important that we not take what people say so heavily, because it can influence how we practice our faith. So those are words of wisdom that helped me quite a bit. And later, Dr. Taha Jabralawani, who was my mentor in the early 2000s, he also reiterated that. He says that, Dai, when you're talking to people, talk to them at the level they understand. Although you could tell them great scholarly things, he says, talk to them as, John and Jane Q. Muslim. And you'll get better responses to them than to stand up and pontificate, where they won't understand what you're saying and they leave more confused than when they came.
Great stories. Imam, I don't have to tell you this. This is a tumultuous world. There are a lot of things going ways that we don't want them to go. What gives you hope?
Well, I think that there are many things that give me hope. One of them is that I see the brightness and the sparkle in younger people's eyes. And as much as I encourage them to keep thinking forward, keep thinking to achieve things, there, I also caution them not to be too overly optimistic. As the adage goes in the Muslim community, is that trust everybody, but still tie your camel. And so I encourage them to be very open-minded, continue to work with people, but also don't lose yourself completely in the activism. Because if you do, you could find yourself years later poor and disenfranchised because of your activity, and the very people that you may have helped will not be there to support you. So I try to get them to see that we live in a world that's important, and we must make changes to make life better. But also, we have bills to pay, and you may get sick, so you have to take care of yourself and have life insurance and those kinds of things. And that way, you're putting that protection. That's tying your horse, tying your camel, as you continue to trust people and work to make improved lives for a lot of people.
Imam, tell me about the masjid in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to have you pronounce it because I respect it and I don't want to say it the wrong way.
Well, it's Masjid al-Nur, and actually I closed the masjid down a few years ago. One of the problems was that people were fearful to come to the mosque, and though people would come, meaning that I did it for well over 4 years, almost 5 years of practice, one of the problems was that I could not get people to commit so that the masjid would be there whether I was alive or not, or available or not to be there, and I couldn't get that kind of commitment. And I think part of it was fear. I think part of it was there was no real community that had developed and coalesced that allowed that to come about. But now that we have other masjids in other parts of the country, well, in Canada and a few other parts of the U.S., where people have been able to do that, build a community, we do have examples of that, but they're still very few. And one of the things that I think is very important is that people, when they come to these places, they have to be willing to give too. And what I mean by that is, if you're able to come to the masjid and then one Friday out of every 2 months, come and help volunteer, help set up, help, with the different events. If we have like an iftar or something going on, help stay around to help clean up, those kinds of things. Because the burden that put on me over those 4 years, I grew tired too. And so I think that it's just as important, no matter what type of faith that you, the religion you follow, the community building part is always important, and people have to volunteer because in masjids, in many places, they're supported with funding. But mine, we didn't have any funding.
Yeah.
So it's important that people volunteer to make up for that, because that's just those few hours, a few, you know, every month or so, that makes the difference in making certain that other people who come who are in need for community will be able to come there and find it.
I know you've worked with Muslims for Progressive Values as executive director of the Mecca Institute. I have one last question for you, and it's a big one. What one universal message would you like to share that applies to LGBTQ persons of faith, regardless of their particular religion?
Well, I think that one of the things that we have to remind the LGBT community overall is that our parents brought us into this world, and our that responsibility to our parents is that we have to be truthful with them in the best way that we can. It's not that we are to, you know, commit in such a way that if you're a teenager and your parents are in the community, and if they find out that that their child is gay, it can influence how the family's life can be influenced in the negative, that we have to weigh the balance of those things. But it's so important that we recognize, the parents recognize, that no matter what their religious background, they are the parent and they have certain responsibilities to the child. And in reverse, the child has to the parent. And if they really sit down and talk about these things and try to have a better understanding between them, they don't have to agree in the end, but at least they better understand the reasoning and the emphasis that they have, where their heart is at, where their love is at, and how they want to do right by their parents. And the parents should also take the opposite position, that they want to do right by their children. I think they find a much better position where they can still have the dance of parent and child and still be able to find that love between them that's so important, which I found in my relationship with my parents, and I saw with other people who had good relationships with their parents too, and that makes all the difference in the world. I would encourage people to look up Mecca Institute, because our goal is to help re-educate the Muslim community to better understand their Islamic history and how their faith has been influenced through that history. And I think once they are able to better understand that, that they will see Islam in a new light.
As one of only a handful of openly gay imams in the world, Imam Abdullah has been an inspiration to many and a source of controversy for others. But the passion and wisdom he brings to his ministry should be clear from our short conversation. Imam Abdullah, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
You're welcome, and thank you.
This conversation is part of Whosoever You Love, our semi-monthly series affirming the worth and full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion. Whosoever You Love is supported by the Arcus Foundation, which is dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org and find the entire series at www.whosoeveryou.love. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you so much. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.